Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host Jivraj, and on this podcast, I speak with some amazing founders from the Indian Valley, trying to derive the most practical insights to building a startup in India. In this episode, I speak with Suchita Salwan, the co-founder and CEO of LBB, which is an abbreviation of Little Black Book. I am calling this episode, It Starts With Curiosity, because Suchita's journey personifies this statement. It's phenomenal how sheer curiosity led Suchita to go out there and explore, and what started off as a Tumblr blog is now a startup that millions of users across India truly love. Little Black Book, LBB, is a marketplace that helps us explore the unexplored about everything under the sun. From the best of bags, to the best of shoes, to the best of biryani. You name it, LBB will help you find it. With the quirky and amazing notifications, LBB is one app on my phone that I truly, truly cherish. Moving on to introducing Suchita. Suchita is this insanely cool and amazing person who always strives to learn, deeply cares, and is building something phenomenal. A graduate of economics from Hindu University, she graduated in 2011 and went on to work for 2 years before starting to work full-time on LBB. She is super cool, super humble, and wonderful all in all. She hosts a wonderful podcast called the LBB Open House series herself, and you should definitely tune in for some amazing insights. Twitter and Instagram are phenomenal too, and basically, if you do not follow what she's up to, you are missing out. Having said that, the episode does live up to the built-up expectations. I had a treat through the wonderful 1 hour plus conversation and took back so much. From community building, to care, to innovation, culture, and so much more. Let's dive in to the 26th episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast, It Starts With Curiosity, with LBB's Suchita Salwan. This episode is brought to you in association with the Entrepreneurship Cell of Hindu College, Delhi University. Without further ado, I would like to welcome Ms. Suchita Salwan on the show. Thank you so much, Suchita, for joining me. It's such a pleasure to host you.
Great to be here, man.
Today's episode is particularly interesting for me because, you know, your founding story is something that is really inspiring, especially for a 22-year-old doing a podcast by himself. So I'd like to begin the episode with, let's say, an abstract thought before we dive into the founding story and more startup concepts that we'll hear from you. And, you know, bring out there as to the importance of passion projects for especially youngsters in college or before that even. So given that, you know, the founding story of LBB is such that you began in college, what are some of your, you know, principles around how passion projects should be dealt with, what is its importance for youngsters, and how we should look at them?
So LBB didn't begin in college. It actually began 3.5-4 years into my work life. And I was with the BBC when I started LBB. The way I'll interpret your question is, what's the use case of passion projects? So where you're correct is that it did start as a passion project. I think the word like passion is a bit of a double-edged sword. There have been a couple of speeches that have been circulating recently, one by Scott Galloway. There's another really good one by Chamath, which he had given at Stanford. And in both those speeches, they talk about how, you know, passion is following your passion is, you know, is the biggest sort of lie, so to speak, sold to, you know, kids, at least of my generation, and I'm not much older than you are. But I think I will, you know, I 100% agree with that sentiment, which is, I think the thing with passion projects or whatever you may want to call them is, essentially they should be used as ways in which you expand your mind's horizon, right? So there are a lot of things that I continue continue to be passionate about, right? I am super passionate about, you know, design. I'm really passionate about art. I'm really interested in, like, you know, reading. Just because I'm passionate about reading doesn't mean I would make even an iota of a good writer, right? So I think my sort of take on, you know, young kids who are in college, who are thinking of starting passion projects, or, you know, or like doing things on the side for fun, the way you need to look at it, or at least the way I would suggest one looks at it, is use it as a way to open your mind's eye, right? Use it as a way to broaden your horizon. Use it as a way to even challenge your own assumptions. There's so much that I've learned from, deep diving into things that I'm passionate about. And I think that's what it really is. So yeah, on passion projects, use them as a way to, you know, open your mind's eye. LBB started, I don't even think it started as a passion project. I think it started more so, you know, out of curiosity. I was not remotely passionate about Delhi, right? I had, you know, no interest in like small to mid-sized businesses. But I think I was just curious. So I think with LBB, it was more of like, you know, exploring my curiosity versus exploring something that I was, you know, passionate about. Over a period of time, of course, the problem statement of LBB and the problem statement of what we're doing today drives me a lot, which is why, you know, to date, I still do what I do. But yeah, I hope that addresses your question.
It does. It does, like, makes me remind of this speech I once, you know, heard of Ben Horowitz. Title was "Don't Follow Your Passion." So I get what you're saying to an extent, and you know, part of that I can relate to as well, because part of why I began the podcast is due to curiosity of, you know, how founders build companies. And stemming from there itself, I'd love to, you know, probably hear from you again as to, you know, if we can take a deep dive into this founding story of LBB. You know, how you went from content to the platform that it is right now, and what was that, you know, aha moment that made you realize that this is something that users are actually willing to use as well. So if you can probably reflect upon, let's say, the 0 to 1 journey for LBB, that'd be wonderful to hear.
So I think, you know, as I'd said, LBB started out more as a sort of extension of my curiosity. I have been, you know, born and brought up in Delhi. And like most, true Delhiwalas, I have a very love-hate relationship, with this city. And I think, at the BBC, I was doing really well. I had a, you know, great boss. My work was really interesting. So I had no reason to leave as such. And essentially for me, you know, LBB, back when it started as a Tumblr page, was basically just a way for me to, understand more of what Delhi has to offer. And that's actually how LBB started, right? Nothing else. I think the transition from, you know, going from a Tumblr page to a website to an app, the sort of transition from content to, you know, community-led commerce, which is what we sort of, you know, transitioned into today. I think a lot of that came from, two things. One, understanding who the customer for LBB is. So, for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with LBB, we're essentially a marketplace to discover and shop from India's most amazing independent brands and businesses. And we're, you know, multi-category marketplace, which also comes with its own sort of like set of complexities and challenges. But I think step number one was, you know, sort of identifying what are we, right? Are we a platform? Are we a marketplace? Because there's a difference in between the two, right? I think back when LBB started, our approach was very like platform-esque, right? Where we were a platform for people who were discovering interesting things in and around them, to share those interesting, you know, brands, businesses, etc. on LBB. But I think the 0 to 1 really happened when we realize that, you know, really the narrative of LBB is that it's not a platform, but it is a marketplace. And when you sort of figure out the difference in between the two, right, everything from who your customer is to who your user is to who your consumer is, all of that becomes, you know, much more clearer, and you're able to develop products for different sort of parts of your businesses with more ease, than earlier. So, we had very humble beginnings, but obviously, you know, over the past couple of years, we've sort of like grown from 100,000 users a month to, pre-COVID, we were close to about 5 million monthly active users across our web and our app. We hardly had some 3,000-4,000 brands and businesses is listed and recommended on our platform. Today, we've got, you know, over 60,000 brands and businesses that are listed and recommended on our platform, 4,000 of which you can actually shop from now on LBB. You know, you can inquire from thousands of them on LBB as well. So we've also diversified, you know, our offering to both the user and the consumer. But I think for us, the real 0 to 1 came from being able to articulate, you know, what is it that we're building? Is it a platform? Is it a product? Is it a brand? Is it a marketplace? Like, what is it? And then just, you know, sharpening our focus on different elements of a marketplace, which, you know, helped us grow at the pace we were able to.
Fair. Wow, those are some spectacular numbers, and the journey speaks for itself. And glad to hear this, because especially in the West Bengal audience, like I can speak for my city, LBB is a very famous app, and you know, we're always checking it out. And I love the differentiation, as you explained, between, as I said, you know, I also mentioned it to be a platform, but the differentiation between the platform and marketplace and the ideology that can help identify what the consumer base is. Right. From there, you know, I'd like to go into another abstract thought, after which we can dive into a couple of detailed things. But the Indian startup ecosystem, right? And especially for somebody as young as you, when you began straight out of somewhere out of college, then you work and then you observe the ecosystem for a while, and then you've been a part of it since then. So would love to understand, you know, how you've seen the ecosystem mature, and especially since we enter the next decade, what are some of your observations for how it's going to, you know, go further for youngsters out there?
So, you know, when we raised our first round of investment, I was about 25. And I think that's when I really got introduced to this ecosystem. I had no idea what half of this shit was, right? Like, I didn't know what a cap table was. I didn't know what VCs did. You know, one may argue, I still don't know what VCs do, but that's a joke, guys. That's a joke. But I think, you know, when I started out, I had absolutely no idea about what this ecosystem was about, because I was also fairly new to it. My background is in marketing, operations, etc. I come from a very different world to, you know, the world that is product tech, startup, etc., etc. And I think for me, you know, the first couple of years of navigating this ecosystem came with its own sort of challenges, not for anything else, but it's more of, you know, you're also new to building a business, right? You're also new to building a company, hiring people, scaling your product, you know, understanding who your merchants are, your consumers are, etc. I think, you know, my biggest sort of takeaway has been, I don't think there's a single ecosystem that at least I've come across within India that is as dedicated to learning as the startup ecosystem is. And that's why I frankly love being a part of it, right? Everyone from, you know, founders to employees to mentors, advisors, venture capitalists, LPs, everyone comes with a sense of curiosity. And I think that's what makes being a part of this ecosystem so riveting. And you know, though I don't necessarily encourage people to start companies fresh out of college, because I do think that there are things that, you know, working at large structured companies can teach you. I do think at some point, if you can navigate your career in a way where you become a part of this ecosystem. Now, for some people, wanting curiosity is something that could come in their mid-20s, as it happened for me. For others, it could come, you know, when you're in your late 30s and you're looking at, you know, stepping out of your comfort zone and your sort of, you know, environment and your box. So when this curiosity, you know, sort of clicks with you, that obviously is a culmination of your own personal experiences. But you know, I would highly encourage people to figure out a way to just engage with this ecosystem, even if not formally, but informally, because I haven't come across a group of people or a consortium of people who are so committed to learning, you know, as much as this particular ecosystem. And that's why it's actually a lot of fun being a part of it, right? I mean, you and I would have never met, right? Conversations like this don't happen. But you know, what is and you've obviously got so many interesting guests on your podcast. But I think the reason why people are keen on talking to anyone and everyone is because what unites the both of us, even though we may not have much in common, is that we're both interested in learning about new things, right? Which is why you're doing what you're doing. And I think that's what makes this ecosystem, you know, truly special.
Right. Yeah, very important factor there, and you know, goes to show the importance of learning in general as well. And I can testify to it, as you mentioned, because for some great folks to give me time as a 22-year-old is like a great humility and great learning on that part. So that's really commendable about the ecosystem. So, Chita, moving from there itself and diving a bit deeper into, you know, the interesting things that I found out during my research about LBB. So, first up, I want to ask a bit about revenue models, right? And given that the audience is such that we're targeting, you know, aspiring founders, it'd be very fascinating to hear from you if you can probably lay down some revenue models that you were, you know, juggling with, because given the kind of marketplace you are in, there must be multiple avenues that are available. So if you could probably lay it down for us, and how do you go about choosing them, or what's the, you know, insight like internally before you play with them, is something that is very interesting to hear from you.
So basically at LBB, we have three revenue streams. Some are more advanced than the other. So one part of it is advertising and marketing solutions for brands and businesses. The other part of it is on-platform transactions. And the third part of it is services. And services are obviously largely targeted towards our merchant and our brand community. So because we're a marketplace, on one side, we have, you know, users. On the other side, we have, you know, brands and businesses. We basically largely work with independent brands. So 90% of the brands that you will discover and find on LBB will be in the small to mid-size lifestyle brand cohort. And then there'll be about 10% which are larger, you know, better established brands. Essentially, what we realized, you know, back when we started out and over the past couple of years, is if you look at today's environment, right, a lot of your larger problems to solve have been already solved by fairly successful and large companies, right? So the problem of aggregation and organization of information has been solved by Google, right? The transition of more everyday, daily commerce, so to speak, which happens offline, that transitioning to online has happened thanks to companies like Amazon, Flipkart, and the likes. Travel aggregation has happened by, you know, booking.com, Make My Trips, etc. of the world. So I think a lot of the, you know, foundational elements of the internet to a large extent have been taken care of. And I think, you know, that gives founders and creators and businesses a unique opportunity to build on top of stacks that have already been created. I think with us, a lot of what we realized was that, we can't play the aggregation game, because the aggregation game has already been played and won by very good, very large businesses. And there's no point getting into their territory, right? Does the world need another Amazon? No, because Amazon's already doing a good enough job of it. But is Amazon the only way to purchase on the internet? Not at all, right? Which we've seen through, large platforms like, you know, Nykaa, Big Basket, etc., emerge in India that have, you know, not just existed, but they've thrived despite, large companies like Amazon and Flipkart being there. The larger point that I'm getting to is that, you know, even in India till date, a single digit percentage of offline commerce has actually transitioned online. And I think for us, what we realized was that, you know, there is an opportunity to onboard more of this commerce, online, but do it in a way where the value creation on both the customer and merchant side is much more, happens much more deeply as opposed to superfluously. So what exactly do I mean by that? Essentially for us, a lot of what we build on is how do we own the full stack for merchants and for brands who are on our platform? And also how do we own the full stack for users who are on our platform, which is why we're multi-category, right? So the way we build solutions is, if you're a brand, right, and if you come to LBB, every single need that you have, which basically falls within your distribution and marketing funnel, LBB should be able to solve for it. If not now, then over a period of time. So for example, we have this really interesting brand called Oldtree, right? Which is it's a small shop based out of Humayunpur, which is a small sort of, you know, area behind Saftajang in Delhi. And they sell bags, and they're one of the best sellers, you know, on LBB. Now, this guy had never sold online before. But through LBB, you know, he was able to create content. Through LBB, he was able to get his logistics sorted out, his packaging sorted out, his cataloging sorted out. And essentially what ended up happening was we ended up owning more of his marketing stack, from his, you know, awareness to consideration to fulfillment and transaction. And just owning more of the merchant's marketing stack gives us leverage. Not only, and leverage is not a bad word, but essentially it gives us leverage over the merchant, right? Because essentially the merchant starts counting on you for fulfilling more of what, you know, their needs and requirements are, as opposed to, you know, just using, you know, one sliver of what your, you know, value proposition and what your product offering is. So a lot of how we thought of LBB was we actually modeled a lot of what we do from Alibaba, actually, more than, you know, traditional e-com platforms like an Amazon, because what we realized was that, you know, the thing that's limiting small to mid-sized lifestyle brands and businesses in India isn't that they aren't capable. It isn't that they don't have good products. In fact, they have great products at very affordable prices, right? So like an average, you know, good quality bag on LBB doesn't cost more than, you know, 800 to 900 rupees, and it's cheaper than what you'd find at mass market brands like in H&M and the likes. So a lot of, and that has nothing to do with us. We have less than 10% discounting on LBB, but the reason why we're able to deliver on such great prices is because that Indian merchant is actually that good. But the only thing holding them back is that somewhere along their marketing and distribution stack, they get lost, right? They either screw up their logistics, or they, you know, aren't very good with customer support, or they're terrible at content creation and they have no interest in, you know, SEO, influencer marketing, or whatever else. So a lot of what our thesis became was, you know, what if we just help the merchant with the full stack of, you know, whatever it is that they need, and then, you know, build our business up from there. So for example, today, a merchant like Oltree, you know, would be working with us across our across all verticals. In fact, you know, they'll work with us on advertising and marketing, they'll work with us on commerce, they'll work with us on services. And that just helps us unlock much more value to the merchant, and also therefore, you know, to the customer. So I think, I think when you're thinking of business models, when you're thinking of, how to monetize your business, at least my opinion is that the future businesses that will come out will be much like LBB. They'll be much more full stack in nature, because otherwise the aggregation game, right? I will offer one thing to millions of merchants across the globe. That's very, very difficult to win in, because either, you know, you need to be in a space like payments, where you're kind of like the lowest common denominator, which is basically facilitating a transaction on the internet, or you need to, you know, be like Amazon, where you've just got so much selection coming into your ecosystems, which is very difficult to do when businesses on both those sides already exist. So what's really helped us is, you know, looking at slightly more, offbeat, but highly scaled products and platforms. So we looked a lot at Etsy, we looked at Shopify, we looked at Alibaba. We looked at a lot of your non-obvious, we looked at malls in fact, you know, because LBB in a way is like a mall on the internet, right? Where you come to our platform and you discover all of these great brands and businesses, and there's this element of window shopping. So I think what's really important is just broaden the scope. Don't only restrict yourself to, you know, only evaluating X type of business because you feel like you have the most affiliation with that, and just broaden your horizon in terms of who you look at for inspiration.
Right. Very fascinating to hear. And, you know, goes to show that, you know, the smaller elements and taking inspiration from the right resources matter. And love the fact that you mentioned, you know, owning the full stack of the problems or the solutions and making life easier for both ends of the supply chain. So great to hear that. But stemming from there, without getting too repetitive, you did mention, you know, along the way of your answer that there are so many larger players, right? And a large part of the reservation amongst youngsters is that, you know, wherever we go, there is a larger player already present, right? So just to, you know, connect the dots and maybe refer from you as to what are some of the competitive moats, like you mentioned, you know, the stack one and, you know, being able to fulfill the entire experience. What are some of the other competitive moats that LBB SEBI is using, such that, you know, even if a larger player were to enter the market in a model of aggregation or, you know, owning the entire problem, what would that, you know, what would the standout feature for LBB be then as well?
So I think you could have very large players in a business, but a lot of what we see happening on the internet, which is not new, but it's actually happened over the past 5-6 years, is there's been unbundling happening across the realm, right? So there was a business as large as Craigslist or eBay at, you know, a certain point in time, and different verticals of that business have sort of like unbundled from the larger, you know, cohort or the larger conglomerate that existed earlier. And that's continuing to happen. So just because there is a large business that exists, it doesn't mean, and the best example is actually Airbnb, right? One could argue that the travel industry was, you know, fairly well aggregated because you have a Priceline, Booking, et cetera, et cetera. But Airbnb came out of nowhere because it offered a differentiated experience at a really competitive price to customers. And it actually unlocked a totally new type of merchant, right? It didn't go after large hotel chains. It just basically unlocked a totally new type of like merchant on the supply side. I think actually the same thing has happened for LBB, where on the supply side, we've unlocked a very new type of merchant who otherwise wasn't used to selling online, being discovered online or even using online tools or digital tools that much to drive, business for themselves. So on average, a business that, is on LBB is omnichannel. To date, a lot of them, about 60% of their business comes from more offline channels, whether it's things like, you know, exhibitions and pop-ups or their own retail stores or, selling at offline markets, et cetera, et cetera. So I think a lot of what we were able to do on the supply side was aggregate a type of merchant who otherwise is very difficult to access online. So to date, 70% of the brands who sell on LBB and 80% of the brands who are on LBB, listed, recommended, whatever, they're not easy to access on any other large marketplace. So most of the brands that are on LBB are actually not on an Amazon, they're not on, you know, a Flipkart, they're not on any large e-com marketplace. And I think for us, that has been a real sort of like big differentiator. On the consumer side, similar to what happened for Airbnb and travel, what we realized was that LBB is not creating a new behavior, right? Consumers like shopping. They like discovering new things, right? And a lot of this has been accelerated because of social media platforms where it's almost like all of us are always on a hunt, right? Like we're on like a dopamine hunt, right? Like you're looking for your next adrenaline hit, which comes from finding something that no one has ever found before and being able to Instagram it and, you know, brag about it to your friends. So on the customer side, the customer insight that we had was and a phrase that, you know, I use is accelerated signaling, right? Where earlier, I don't know about you, but like at least for my parents, their idea of, for the lack of a better word, quote unquote, showing off was, you know, like the car that they owned or the watch that they had, you know, or like the address that they have, right? I'm consumers like you and me and even Indian millennials at large, we don't really give a shit about any of those things, right? From us, signaling comes through the cool coffee mug that you drink your coffee in, right? Or signaling comes through the artisanal coffee that's in that goddamn coffee mug, right? Or signaling comes through, you know, these new pair of shoes that you bought that, you know, none of your friends have access to. Right. So the term that we use on the customer side is accelerated signaling, where users are looking for smaller objects and they're using those smaller objects to signal their quality of life to their peers, friends, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not like that behavior is new, that behavior exists. I think through the supply that we have, we're just able to instigate that behavior at a much more higher frequency, you know, than before. And I think for us, that really is a competitive moat, right? Where you're onboarding a supply, which didn't really exist on the internet before. You're also doing it in a way where you're not telling the customer, come to me only when you want to buy. You're telling the customer, come to me when you want to shop, right? When you want to browse a little, when you want to have fun, finding new products and new things and new brands online. And essentially, by providing these really interesting, unique products at affordable prices, you're able to also tap into that customer insight of accelerated signaling and giving them those, you know, objects that help them show you know, to their friends, community, etc., the quality of life that they're leading.
Right. Wow, this is again a very interesting concept that you've introduced, and you know, goes to show that if you can play with these nudges that the consumers already have and, you know, build upon them, then you can actually like build something out of it. And I think that's my takeaway from it. And I love the, you know, little tweaks again and how you've seen the product journey through for the consumer and built upon it. You know, coming from there itself, another major factor about LBB, you know, because before when I was doing my research, I asked all my friends and everybody was like, you know, as you said, like it's a great app to, you know, scroll, understand and get these new options for. So this community factor that you've built, you know, like a group of followers who are like very, you know, if they want to find something new or want to have something, so they go on LBB. So the community factor is what I'm trying to eye at. And how did you, you know, building communities is something which is going to be the future, and we already see that so many top brands are built on communities. So any tips there for youngsters? How was the journey for LBB like for community building, if you have anything to mention there?
So I think, you know, community building, though it's now the fad, we've invested in it for the past 5 years, right? And it's nice being ahead of the curve on those things. But I think for us, you know, earlier we invested a lot in our user community. And I think over the past 2 years, we started also investing heavily in our merchant community, because a lot of what we realized was that, you know, actually our product is a merchant, right? Our product is this brand that has these great, you know, products that our consumers want to discover or shop from on LBB. I think for us, the journey of community building has been very interesting, because it's basically the thing that you must do only if you're willing to play the long game. Right. I see a lot of brands buy their way into community building. It's not difficult to pay a bunch of influencers and get them to talk about your brand. Right. It's not difficult to, you know, send free products worth lakhs and lakhs of rupees and get people to post about it on, you know, YouTube and Instagram. What's really, really tough is getting, you know, users, getting your true fans to, you know, and sort of creating like creating a system wherein they are empowered to tell their friends and family that, hey man, I really like this LBB app and I found, you know, really cool things on this app, so you should download it too. And that, in my opinion, is community, right? It is the group of people who will support you even when you're not paying them any money. And I think that's the way, you know, brands must look at community. And I think actually that's what helped us out with LBB, you know, on day one, you know, up until our last round, most of our growth actually just came from word of mouth. And that word of mouth, you know, actually the kudos for that lies in our community, right? Our community of users, content creators, everyone else who, you know, just absolutely love the experience of what LBB has to offer. I think what I'd love to talk about is the work that we've done on the merchant side, because again, you know, there's no dearth of like marketplaces, but I think a lot of them end up treating their merchants like commodities, right? So if not you, I'll find someone else, right? There are 60 million MSMEs in India. There's no dearth of finding another bag guy or another shoe guy, right? What we realized was that, you know, this merchant is actually very curious. They're willing to learn. They want to make more money. But in order for them to do any of those three things, they just need someone to help, you know, bridge the gap in between where they're at right now and where they can be. And over the course of, you know, last year and this year, we've done a lot for our merchant community. So, you know, similar to what you're doing, I host a podcast called LBB Open House. And that's actually targeted towards our merchant community, you know, and it's a way for them to learn from experts, learn from people who've built really great brands and businesses, and get insights and tips from them, right? We did this other great initiative this year called Local Biz Fam, where we, you know, gave out free ad inventory worth about 2.5 crores right after the pandemic hit, because even we realized that, you know, these merchants are in the doldrums. We need to help them out. We've also done things like, you know, maker meetups, where we've given merchants a lot of data and insight about, you know, what are the key trends, what are the colors that are working for our users, what are the styles that are working for our users, you know, so they're able to create more products along those lines. And I think the only way you can build a community is by really caring. There's no substitute for, you know, caring. And I know it's not a metric. It's not a data point. It's not a book. It's not something tangible. But there is no replacement for actually caring about the success of, you know, both your consumers and your merchants. And I think what's made us successful is that we really care, right? Even if you talk to my colleagues, they know how, like, you know, how like specific and perturbed I get if, you know, if there is like a delay on the consumer side, right? They know, you know, that like paying our merchants in time is extremely important. And I think there's no substitute for caring. So I leave it at that, where, you know, if you really want to build a great community, find things that you as a founder really care about. And that care, you know, and that affection and that need to please needs to come from the top. You can't hire someone to do the job for you. You need to feel passionately about it, you know, to be able to deliver on it.
Yeah, got it. Again, like, I must commend the fact that at each step and with each answer, you know, there's this new and fresh perspective that I'm hearing, which is almost blowing my mind. Because again, it's easy for us to probably focus on the consumer end, and from the outside it can seem like that, but the fresh perspective of, you know, adding to the other side, the supply side, which is as important if not more, is something that is really great. And the long-term perspective and, you know, looking at the really care factor is something that I'm definitely going to take away. Moving to, you know, another important factor, because I was seeing through your interviews and you mentioned the vision, which I feel is, you know, very inspiring again, that LBB will one day be a global product. And, you know, coming from there itself, you started from, let's say, a city, from an area, from Delhi, right? And you've now grown into multiple cities and it's growing very fast, and you'll be particular more about the numbers, but from the outside, it seems so. So what I'm trying to now add is that, given that, you know, a market-based product does, and in your model does, involve multiple stakeholders, what is your internal strategy to expand, like, you know, go from one city to another? When do you know you're ready? When do you know this is, you know, this is the exhaustion point and we can go to another city? You know, these intricacies, if you may reflect a bit upon, it'll be very great to hear.
So actually what the pandemic helped us out with was we went pan-India immediately, right? Because a lot of what we realized was that, you know, we don't need to have a city-by-city play. Because an interesting data point is most of our top merchants on LBB, they actually get orders from cities that they're not in. So, you know, going back to the example of Old Tree, he's a Delhi-based brand. But 90% of his orders come from Pan India, right? And from outside of Delhi. So a lot of what we, you know, were able to realize was that, you know, our merchandising strategy needs to be local, but our customer acquisition strategy needs to be as widespread as is possible. So think of it this way: if you've ever been to the been to the US or even within India, right? Look at a brand like H&M. What you find at H&M store in Saket will be different from what you find in Vasant Kunj, will be different from what you find in Bangalore, will be different from what you find in Bombay. And that's what I mean by localize your merchandising, right? So today, if you open our app, you know, it asks you to enter your PIN code. It doesn't ask you to enter your PIN code because you can't access stuff outside of your PIN code. But basically, by giving us your PIN code, what you're helping us out with is you're helping us understand, you know, what's the weather like, right? What's the temperature like? What are the kind of foods that Calcutta really likes, right? What are the type of, you know, what are the colors or the patterns that our Calcutta customer really likes? So we're able to essentially show you merchandise which appeals to you versus showing you stuff, you know, which has absolutely nothing to do with you. So, for example, you know, showing a person in Delhi like thick sweaters in the middle of winter totally makes sense, but Bombay doesn't really have a winter, right? So showing those like thick, you know, puffy jackets to a customer in Bombay, you're going to turn them off because that has nothing to do with, you know, what their like life in that city is like. So for us, what we tapped into, you know, this year, and obviously COVID played a large role in accelerating it, was the merchandising needs to be localized to, you know, customers' unique tastes and preferences. But the delivery, the experience, that needs to be sort of pan-India. So to date, you know, we actually have shoppers and users from over 100 cities in India. We have merchants from over 50 cities in India. So, you know, sitting on your phone, you can order this great local brand from you know, from Cochin, or this really interesting, you know, cup from a pottery studio in Pondicherry. So that's a lot of what we've been able to unlock. But I think for us, the big win actually has been that LBB is about a type of person, right? Not where they are. And as long as this tribe of people who are curious, people who are up for trying new things, as long as that tribe keeps growing, you know, our merchants will see success no matter where the customer may be sitting.
Got it. So, you know, again, like taking advantage of the nudges that the ecosystem will provide, and COVID has definitely flattened the world, and great to see that, you know, the approach of localizing merchandising and globalizing, or if, you know, broadening the choices that one has. So wonderful to hear that, Suchita. One last question in terms of the specifics, and then we can probably, you know, move on to the concluding segments. But throughout the episode as of now as well, I've loved, you know, the fact that you are combining statistics along with the story, along with, let's say, a good narration of it, right? And given your background, so what I'm trying to eye at now is, you know, the art of storytelling, is like to call it. Storytelling, as we've heard, is very, very important for all founders, be it different multiple aspects of the business. So maybe you could probably reflect a bit upon, you know, how much storytelling actually helps, and in which aspects. So be it talking to, you know, a consumer, be it talking to your supply side, be it talking to your employees internally, or be it even fundraising. So if you could probably reflect a bit upon that, that'd be wonderful to hear.
So I think storytelling is extremely important, whether it's with your, you know, like you said, whether it's with your employees, your customers, your investors, whoever else. I do think what is extremely important is also adapting what story you're telling to whom, because you know, your merchant wants to hear how they will be successful, right? Yeah. Your customer wants to hear how, you know, their life will change, or their choices will be better if they shop on your platform. Your investors want to hear how they will make not just their money back, but get a crazy good multiple on their investment in you. Yeah. So I think a lot of what I've learned is, you know, I think earlier I made the rookie mistake of telling the same story to everyone. And the problem with that is, you know, the thing that excites your merchant will not be what excites your investor, and it may not necessarily be what excites your consumer as well. It's definitely not what excites your family, right? So whoever you're talking to, you want to adapt your story in a way where, you know, where you're able to almost customize it for, you know, for the audience. And I think the thing with storytelling is your first principles should never change, right? So irrespective of whether I'm talking to you or a customer, merchant, whoever else, the first principles of LBB are rock solid, right? Those don't deviate. But the things, you know, like for the lack of a better word, the masala that you add, right? That changes depending on who's palette you're feeding, you know, and that changes based on, you know, who's really listening to what the story is. Extremely important. But, you know, my like pro tip would be just to remember to customize it, because the thing that excites one person may not necessarily be as relevant to, you know, another person.
Got it. So adapt to the situation and to the kind of audience you're addressing. So, you know, maybe just like a follow-up from that itself, there's a lot of literature written on how to talk to users, right? Especially in the early journey, right? And when you probably, you know, if you could probably reflect upon how it was for LBB, because there's a lot being said upon how to not talk about features and maybe listen more and understand user behavior. And the Airbnb stories also there when they, you know, they were going around photographing houses. So maybe if you can probably reflect upon how should founders initially talk to users, and what's the secret there in terms of maybe storytelling or just a general case, if you may.
So, you know, I think the one mistake, you know, even I made and I've seen a lot of founders make is assuming that the consumer will solve your problems, which is not how it works, right? If the consumer could solve their own problems, they'd do it themselves. They wouldn't outsource the problem to, you know, a product, a marketplace, a brand or whatever else. So I think, you know, I think a lot of what I have started doing is I've actually tried to understand who my customer is, where they spend their time, where they spend their money, you know, what is their family life like, what are the things that are important to them, what are the colors that they like, you know, where do they go on the weekends. So a lot of the questions that we ask our users now, or even our merchants for that matter, is just understanding them better. And understanding, you know, their day, their life better. If you go and ask a merchant, you know, what problem do you have? All merchants will say the same problem, right? Ki mujhe aur paise banana hai. But bro, aap paise nahi banaoge if your pictures look like shit, right? You will not be able to make more money if it's taking you 20 days to deliver something that I can, you know, just go to my supermarket and buy the product from there. So I think a lot of what a lot of what has to happen is or the things that have rather the tips that have helped us out a lot is don't really expect the customer to give you the solution that you're looking for, but try to understand their day, their life, their triggers, right, much better, because that's actually where the unlocking, you know, really comes from. If you go and ask a user on the street, you know, do you like shopping from local brands? No one really gives a shit, right? No one wakes up in the morning saying, I want to shop from a local brand, but they wake up in the morning saying, you know, hey man, I want to wear something different today, right? Or like, dude, this coffee is not good. Like, can I switch it up for something else? Or, you know, hey, I'm sick of having Kellogg's. Can I buy another, you know, what are the other options that I have to consume? So I think, yeah, I mean, I'm reiterating a lot of what I'm saying, but the key really is, in being able to think through what are the pain points that a consumer has over the course of their day. And you know, we've seen this time and time and again, right? Uber, no one said, I want to order a cab from my phone, right? In fact, I'm pretty sure people were totally okay with waiting 5 minutes extra for a cab to come. But, you know, something making life for you more convenient suddenly becomes an unlocker of value. Similarly with Amazon Prime, I really do not need toilet paper in like 24 hours, right? I can survive without it. But I think a lot of the magic that companies are able to deliver on, it comes by just understanding, you know, the triggers and the day of a customer better versus, literally seeing what are the inefficiencies in their day and how do I remove those inefficiencies. Because, and just an interesting data point for you there, right? A lot of what at least I've realized is that consumers really like inefficiencies. Everyone is not an average like male from the startup ecosystem on Twitter. They don't use 6 different tools to, you know, make their day more productive. People right. really like being unproductive, which explains Netflix and its success, right? But yeah, just chat with customers, you know, figure out their day, understand, what inspires them, what do they find aspirational, and then build backwards from there.
Right. Absolutely love this one as well, because of the entire ideology of, you know, how we can focus on, let's say, not exact problems, but observe their behavior and build on top of that. Because if they're going to give us the answers, then we wouldn't be there, right? So lovely to hear that and, you know, have that ideology again. One last question here, I've always wanted to. So I've asked other guests on the show, you know, what are the tips to fundraising, and goes to show that, for those who are not familiar, they should know that LBB has some great folks on their cap table, be it institutional investors or angels. But not to ask you the repetitive question and maybe, you know, reflect a bit upon some of the fundraising intricacies. So, you know, if let's say if you had to talk to your 21-year-old self and tell yourself a couple of things regarding fundraising, what would those be, if you can probably, you know, dwell a bit upon, and then we can move on to the last segment.
So, you know, any founder will tell you that fundraising is the most exhausting, like time sucking, like life sucking experience, right? And not for anything else, it just takes time. It takes time to get your pitch right. It takes time to get your business model right. It takes time to even get feedback from the market and then adapt, you know, your pitch, your business model to, in a way where you're able to articulate the value that you're actually going to be able to unlock through your business. So I think, and you know, while obviously when you're in it, it feels like death, but like, and I'm exaggerating, but you get the point, right? Like fundraising is like doing a hit workout. Like you do not like it when you're in it, but just the transformation that you see, or at least that, you know, my co-founder and I have seen where what we've realized is, you know, through the fundraising process, we're able to articulate our business much better, right? We're also able to compartmentalize different parts of our business, you know, much better than otherwise. So I think the tips that I'll give is, you know, really two things. One, make sure that you have your team ready, you know, handling the day-to-day while you're out fundraising, because it's basically 3 to 6 months that are like knocked off your calendar. I think the second thing is really focus on your pitch. Right. Practice your pitch. Send your pitch deck to people who you trust. Right. Get their feedback. And go to people who will rip your pitch into shreds, because a lot of what I've realized is that, you know, we're all looking for validation, right? Like, we're all like, you know, validation seeking monkeys. But the problem is, if you're looking for validation, then, you know, then where you're actually screwing up, if that's not brought to your notice, the last thing that you want is going out to the market with the wrong pitch. I think in our case, you know, things have been easy and things have been difficult. The reason why things have been difficult, honestly, the onus lies on Dhruv and me, my co-founder and I, for the simple reason that, you know, we were not able to very simply and succinctly explain what LBB does, you know, about 5 years ago. So again, it goes back to the question you asked earlier about storytelling, right? We told investors the story that we told consumers. And they are not the same thing, because investors want to hear market size. They want to hear, you know, target addressable market. They want to hear serviceable, obtainable market, right? They want to hear, they want to know how they're going to make their money back. You know, what you want to make sure is that, you know, when you go and pitch to a VC, two things: you do your homework on them. You know, you do your homework on, are they even people who would be interested in what you're building, but really invest in, you know, getting your story right. Because once your story is right, what happens after that is just a function of like luck, timing, and everything else, right? But for luck to play in your favor, your story needs to be correct.
Got it. So getting the story right and, you know, compartmentalizing and the timing factor, as you mentioned. Lovely to hear that. Now, and moving to the founder, you, and maybe, you know, a couple of questions on your ideologies and how you manage LBB. So first up there, you know, I'd love to understand what are some of the things that you do as a founder to cope up with different kind of situations, and what's your, you know, independent time like, which assure that, you know, you're innovating at each stage as well. Because I was going through, you know, a couple of episodes that you have, you know, hosted on the fabulous podcast that I've really taken a lot from, and you mentioned a couple of things there that, you know, you read a lot and you read about conflicting readers at times, and some of those theories were very fascinating. So if you could probably, you know, give us a 2-3 minute deep dive into how you cope up with different mechanisms as a founder and how you are in the workspace or any of the multiple things that you do through the day, it'd be very interesting to hear.
Sure. So, you know, like you mentioned, I thoroughly enjoy like reading. I love listening to podcasts. I read books, I read articles, I read tweets. I just genuinely really like consuming content. And some of the content that I consume could be absolute rubbish, right? Some content could be like very highbrow and like very technical and businessy and deep. But I thoroughly enjoy like the range of content that I consume, because I think, you know, you need time for your brain to rest, right? And what I've realized is that my idea of resting is consuming information that generally puts me at ease, right? So for me, actually, some of the information and content that I like consuming, which puts me at ease, is usually content in the world of design, architecture, and art, because I don't know very much about these subjects. So it's not like I'm consuming that content to like prove a point or to learn something specifically, right? I'm consuming it just for fun. And what I've realized is that the best synthesis of my thoughts and the best synthesis of everything that I may have read that ends up happening operating speed is plateaued, and I'm consuming stuff, but I'm consuming stuff that just helps me open my mind's eye versus, you know, things that, you know, sort of like put me in a scenario where I'm, you know, taking notes or I'm actually having to pay a lot of attention in order to internalize that information. So I think that I thoroughly enjoy doing. I've also this year, you know, taken a made a sincere attempt to also meet new people, because I think, you know, when you're, you know, working, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, you know, you're going from home to office, back to a home, there's a bit of a monotony with, you know, who you talk to, who you exchange ideas with. So this year, you know, I became a part of a very small book club, which has been so much fun. Even with the book club, it's not like all of us read, you know, every single book cover to cover, but it's just such a joy to interact with you know, people who would otherwise be strangers and people who you, you know, otherwise may not have known that you have so much in common with, but you realize the commonality, you know, by just discussing ideas in books. Also, a part of that is also manifested in the form of open house, right? It is a bit of a time suck, which I'm sure even, you know, you've seen, where you have to like research on every guest and, you know, and just make that everything from your recording to your sound to everything is like perfect. I think for me, even that has been a true joy, because same thing, I've had a chance to meet so many people, like learn from so many people that I may not have had access to or even taken the time out to learn or, you know, to learn from, had it not been, you know, for something as like constructive as open house. So, I think just doing a bunch of these different things, you know, is how I end up spending. I sound awfully boring, but that's how I end up spending, a lot of my free time.
No, I wouldn't say you sound boring at all, because it goes to show, like, you know, I'd like to connect this to the learning aspect, and your tweets are, you know, a testament to it as well. Like, I love the shares at times. I remember when you announced the book club, so many people were like, can we be a part of it as well? Because it sounded so interesting. And the fact that you're, you know, willing to meet new people despite all of the stress, if not stress, you know, the work that you have on your plate. And I must say that, you know, open house does not seem like too much of a trouble for you, especially because you're so eloquent through the episodes and the guests, in fact. So kudos on that to you. But, you know, there's one interesting question that I want to ask. And, you know, I've particularly asked about, you know, to founders as to what you're looking in your team, right? And that's more of an hiring concept. But I want to particularly ask you as to how do you optimize for employee success, right? So as some of the folks who are listening, you know, not everybody is going to become a founder. I hope they do, and if they aspire to be. But for folks who are, you know, joining startups, how can founders actually optimize for their growth, for their success, and for employees in general at, you know, their startup?
I think it goes back to, you know, caring. I think that's number one, right? I think the second thing is, you know, it's a bitter truth, but as a founder and as an employer, you can't care about everyone, right? So, you can care about everyone, but you'll care about everyone at different densities, right? Or at different intensities. So there are some people who, you know, you will really care about because they are just proving the amount of value that they are being able to, you know, bring to the table. And they're also showing commitment, right? There are others, for whom they may be treating the work that they're doing as a job, and they're very good at the job, but for them it is a job. And actually my take on it is there's no problem with that. You know, I don't, I think, you know, again, one of the mistakes that I made when I was younger was I bought into this whole spiel about like, everyone needs to love the work that they do and this, that, and the other. But it's not true, man. I mean, some people, you know, may be a graphic designer because, you know, they just want to do graphic design, make a certain amount of money with it. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, some people may be great coders, but for them, you know, the joy lies in the coding, not necessarily in, you know, every single, you know, problem statement that the company may throw at them. So I think at the end of the day, you need to be respectful of the fact that everyone has their own motivations. What you want to make sure is that people who you work with are motivated about their careers, right? So that for me has become a non-negotiable, where, you know, I need to make sure that you are motivated about having a career, because and obviously people's desire for what they want in their career changes, and that's totally okay. But you, at the end of the day, you want to work with people who want to be successful, right? Because if you don't want to be successful, no matter what I do, I can't change things for you, right? So I think the way founders, you know, can really enable their co-workers and employees to grow is, you know, is by figuring out, you know, okay, who are the people in my organization that are actually adding the most value? And how do I ensure that, you know, that the value and the potential of this person is maximized? And at LVB, I actually really love that we guys invest a lot in everyone's growth, right? So for instance, we have, you know, sessions with everyone from partners at Bain to, you know, CMOs, co-founders, et cetera, with our leadership team. where our leadership team is able to ask these people questions directly, right? So recently with our sales team, I got Kuldeep, who used to head enterprise sales for CleverTap, to chat with our sales team about, how to think of their sales funnel and how to sort of, allocate the team and create hierarchies within the team. And it's access to people like this, which becomes a big unlocker for people who you work with. So I think the underlying principle needs to be, you have to work with people who want to be successful, because then when, as a founder, you do the job of introducing them to a book or introducing them to a person, they have the ability to actually learn from that person as much, as they can. And that's the way I'd address that.
Got it. So once you have successful people in the organization, you can create funnels for them to grow further and, grow their path towards that success. Love that thought again. From there, this is in terms of, some founders have told me that, they get to tend to have this administrational work, life can get a bit monotonous. So how do you as a founder keep growing apart from, as you said, you learn and, consume a lot of content? And what's your feedback mechanism like? So, what I'm trying to add here, that when you're managing everything as a founder, how do you ensure that you are yourself as a person growing, and how do you intake feedback? This comes from basically the episode you and Kunal had, and I love that, snippet of feedback, but couldn't really get to hear your thoughts on it. So I'd love if you could address it.
So, I think at the end of the day, the only feedback that matters is that of your customers, right? So, and I think when you're failing as a founder, or when you've, taken the wrong decisions as a founder, your customers will tell you themselves. So you don't have to hear it from your employees. You don't have to hear it from your co-founders. You don't have to hear from your investors. You'll hear it from your customers, right? So I think that's one. I think the second is, there are people within LBB. So we have a very transparent culture where, if I have an issue with someone, which is, obviously work related only, but if I have, if I have like a bone to pick with someone about, about like a metric not moving, or like growth not happening at a certain pace, we have a culture where, you can please be direct, right? Like that's how we guys treat each other. Where, and I think one reason for that is because a lot of us have actually worked with each other for very long. So most of the people who work directly with me, have worked at LBB for anything in between 3 to 5 years. And we're, technically on our 5th and a half year, right? So so most of the people who worked with me have worked from the very beginning, so to speak. And I think that just brings a level of trust and transparency that, nothing else can, really sort of buy. So if I am ever, making a wrong decision, I know that I have people who have worked with me and I have worked with for long enough where they'll be the first ones to call out saying, what, I think this is incorrect. Can we look at, doing things another way? So really have, identify people within your organization who will call you out, when things are not stacking up the way that you need them to be stacked up, right? I think the third feedback loop, or at least the way, I make sure that I'm, getting the right inputs, from my teams is doing collective tasks. So for example, when we did the Maker Meet this year, right, which was our sort of event for our Maker community that obviously happened on Zoom, that was done collaboratively with 3 to 4 members, of our team and me. And these are members from across the spectrum, right? Like there'll be people right. who've just joined LBB. There'll be people, who are in a vertical that I may not have directly interacted with earlier. And I think just coming together to work on like a really interesting project, that also, helps you get feedback loops, because it's in those informal conversations that you're actually able to even realize, how people are feeling about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, what are the challenges that people are running into, and how do you, remove that friction, internally as a founder as well. So yeah, so work on collective projects, identify those key people internally who will always keep your head screwed on correct. And also just listen to your customers, right? Because at the end of the day, you'll know if you're making the right or wrong decisions by just, hearing straight from your customers.
Right. So the customer focus again, and I don't think I have much to add there, but it was perfectly summed up. Before the last question, I know, so this is going to be like a stereotypical one. And if we've had, I've interviewed Sari for, you know, the women entrepreneur that exists. So since you are in an ecosystem where, you know, we don't see as many women founders as we'd like, and since you are somebody who's been a part of the ecosystem for long now, without generalizing as such, like, what are some of the gaps that you think are, or if you have any, you know, particular message for young women founders out there, aspiring ones who can, you know, go on to create an impact in the ecosystem. Just want to know your opinion on that and maybe, you know, move to the concluding question then.
Sure. So I think, I mean, this is a conversation that can last an hour unto itself, right? But I think the one thing that I'll say is, you know, somewhere the metric of success needs to change from building unicorns to driving impact, right? Every business does not need to be a unicorn. There are a lot of businesses that, you know, have that make a lot of profit, you know, feed a lot of people, you know, employ a lot of folks, and there is an equal merit in that, right? So I think somewhere how we as a community define success or failure, that needs to change. The problem is the metrics that the startup community uses to measure their own success or failure, they kind of project those metrics onto people who maybe are like really not interested in being measured by the amount of GMV that they're generating or whatever else that, or their valuation, et cetera, right? So I think step number one, the thing that needs to change is what matters to, you know, me as a founder in a particular, you know, ecosystem or world or, you know, product line and category may not necessarily matter to someone else. And it doesn't make one person better than the other. It's just two different universes that can very happily coexist, right? So I think that's one. I think the second is, which I'm seeing happen now, given how obsessed people have become about quote unquote direct to consumer brands. A lot of D2C brands, and though I hate the term D2C because hardly any of these brands are actually direct to consumer. Most of them are available in multiple retail shelves and on multiple marketplaces. But I think the I think a lot of what that has helped unlock is tapping into a female founder who may not be technical, but has great customer insight, has great product insight, and basically uses technology as an enabler to unlock value across, you know, multiple different streams, right? I think for me, obviously, my co-founder is, you know, male and technical. He comes from, you know, he's a Carnegie Mellon graduate, comes from a world of like product and tech. So we were able to balance that out internally. But I think a lot of the challenges that female entrepreneurs end up running into from a funding perspective is that, you know, because they are non-technical, again, it goes back to just the way employment or even education is thunk of, right? If you've got less than 30% women going to engineering colleges, obviously your top of funnel for female founders is going to be, especially if your lens is only technical, is going to be limited. So I think by just widening the scope of what you count as a startup and the kind of companies that can give you great multiples, I think that, I think now that that's changing, I hope that we see many more, you know, female entrepreneurs on the rise.
Right. I hope for the same. And again, like one of the important factors that you mentioned is, you know, how we think of success and failure as a community. And maybe if we can reflect back there, that'd be great. But lovely to hear that. And, you know, all throughout the episode, I've loved the fresh perspective and the energy and what you're doing. For the last question, I know you don't like this a lot because you've mentioned this earlier, but I can't help but generalize and, you know, ask you to leave us with a parting thought. It could be, you know, lessons that you'd like to, you know, probably give a younger self, or because you're not that, you know, older either, but in the little amount of time that you've been a part of the ecosystem, you've learned so much and you've shown so much to us users and given us so much utility. So it'd be lovely to hear from you as to, you know, a couple of last lessons from your journey, which is, I'm sure, going to be an eventful one as we see you further rise and shine.
So I think what I leave you with is, you know, there's that famous saying, right, that you're a function of the five people you surround yourself with, or whatever that saying is. But I think, you know, I'll reiterate that, where, you know, who you surround yourself with, the people who you learn from, the people who challenge you, The books that you read, the content that you consume, all of that, you know, helps create a framework within which your unconscious mind operates. And a lot of what you want is to make sure that your unconscious mind is operating in a way that is, you know, constructive. And the only way to do that is by surrounding yourself with things that, and I wouldn't say surround yourself with people that lift you up, right? I think that's garbage. You don't need yes people around you, but what you need is people who will challenge you, you know, test your assumptions, double test your hypothesis, you know, and also people who've made really interesting life choices. And I think by just doing that, you know, what that helped me out a lot with is it just helped me, same thing, right? Open my mind's eye, right? And there really is no substitute to having an open mind. So I think as long as you're creating situations, you know, for yourself where you're able to talk to people who you don't know with an open mind, right? Where you're able to listen to conversations that you may disagree with, but have an open mind. I think just having an open mind, you know, and not being so fixated with this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, right? I think the problem is even with our education system, you're taught that there is a good answer and there is a bad answer, right? Like there is a right answer and there is a wrong answer. And I think somewhere in that, a lot of what unfortunately happened with a lot of us is just like the nuance of life, right? Like a lot of that got lost in our formative years. So I think I spent my 20s just, you know, almost like rejigging the way my brain works. And I think for me, you know, it's been great, man. And I would highly encourage people to, you know, make sure they do what they do. I think honestly, and I say this with a lot of regard, but that's literally the only reason why I said yes to this, right? Because for me, I was just like, what a cool guy, man. Like he doesn't seem like he's that old. You know, he doesn't seem like he's from this ecosystem, but what a cool guy. He's reaching out to all of these people and, you know, doing whatever it takes to get those interviews in, you know, he's being curious, he's approaching people, you know, with an open mind. And for me, you know, that's why, I mean, I don't particularly like doing too many of these, but for me, it was like, man, if this guy can, you know, have an open mind and, you know, do so much at just 22, the least I can do is, you know, be there for a conversation. And I think, and I think that's really what it is, you know, I think a lot of people who, you know, who have an open mind, they thoroughly love meeting other people who exhibit, you know, the same traits. So, actually kudos to you, dude. It's not easy to do what you're doing. And I'm honestly really impressed. So yeah, you don't need this lesson. Your guests can double tap on this. You seem to be on the right track.
No, that's very kind of you, but goes to show that, you know, if you surround yourself with the right people, they'll make the mark. And I'm like, you're really kind to have those kind words about me, because I know that I've been inspired by you, and for you to, you know, spare the amount of time that you have, and we've extended this conversation because it was so lovely, but to just hear from you in person has been finally so great. And I'm sure this is going to be very helpful for folks like me who, you know, look up to you, have used your product. Because for me, that, you know, the curiosity of being able to speak to the creator of a product that I've used is simply amazing. And I'm sure like everybody who's listening will also be really thrilled to, you know, hear from you and the amazing things you've mentioned through the episode. So with that, you know, thank you so much, Ruchita, for the honor. It's been such a pleasure to be able to host you.
Thanks so much, Ivraj. Thanks for having me, and all the very best.
Wow, that was spectacular. Absolutely candid, real, authentic, and true. Wonderful anecdotes and great insights. I loved the episode, and I hope you did too. This is the 26th episode. That means 25 plus episodes, guys. I cannot thank you enough for the support. I absolutely love the fact that I am so far off in the journey, and it has only just begun. To celebrate the milestone of 25 episodes dearly, I am introducing to you new experiments, if I may. Check out the description of the episode for a Calendly link that will direct you to an open calendar with slots I have reserved to talk to the listeners of the podcast. I believe this shall be extremely instrumental in building the podcast, and I hope to have some wonderful conversations along the way. So book a slot and let's have a chat. Feedback, advice, suggestions, and anything else. Book a chat and let's discuss. The second thing is an open NPS calculator and feedback survey. This shall be perpetually attached to all episodes here on, and I hope you take out 1 minute of your time to fill it up. With that, I would like to thank you for tuning in. That was it from the 26th episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. It starts with curiosity with Suchita Salwan of LBB. This episode was brought to you in association with the Entrepreneurship Cell of Hindu College, Delhi University. Do subscribe to the WhatsApp newsletter if you haven't already. And with that, I take your leave and I thank you again for tuning in. I will see you next week for another episode. Till then, I hope you recall. If you never try, you'll never know. Stay tuned and keep building.